Hello again. This is Renee Ford Clark for the Georgia Radio Reading Service, continuing with My Nightlife is 24/7 by Fiona Page. This is the second reading from this book, which was published in 2011 by Seascape Press. Now, if you remember the last time Fiona was talking about how she won, much to her surprise, the Christa McAuliffe Award for $25,000. And in preparation to get herself together to, let's see. Hello again. This is Renee Ford Clark for the Georgia Radio Reading Service, continuing with the book My Nightlife is 24/7 by Fiona Page. This is the second reading from this book, which was published in 2011 by Seascape Press. Now, if you remember the last time, Fiona has just won the Christa McAuliffe $25,000 award, and she is preparing to make a tour of schools throughout Georgia to train teachers in using the art of storytelling as a teaching tool. But in preparation for her training, she has had an intermittent nagging pain in her abdomen, and she thinks that it's a hernia, so she's gone to a doctor to see about it. And the doctor seems rather odd. He doesn't have MD after his name. He has DO, Doctor of Osteopathy. But based on the recommendation of a friend, she continues to move forward and has signed blank forms that the doctor believes the doctor knows what he's doing, and she's anxious to move forward. Now let's continue. The next morning, with Jerry by my side, I was admitted to the hospital as an outpatient. The plastic surgeon strolled into my room with his magic marker and demonstrated the locations for the liposuction. Jerry walked out. When he returned, he said, "I thought you weren't going to do that." I snapped back with, "It's my decision." Jerry just looked at me for a second and turned quickly, walking away without another word. Several hours later, I woke in the recovery room to the face of another physician who said, "I am the bearer of bad news." "What do you mean? Where's my doctor?" "Oh, he's out of town." That was quick, I thought. The doctor continued, "Well, the good news is we did not find a hernia. The bad news is that you've had a major laparotomy. You'll be out of work for 6 weeks instead of 10 days. "Why?" "He was searching for the pain you described." "I've had my stomach cut open for nothing? A cut like a cesarean?" "Oh, no, no, not 6 weeks. I told my boss I'd be only out for 10 days. No qualified substitute was available to teach my class on storytelling techniques. Would other teachers have to pick up the overload? If not, I wondered what my kids were going to do, stare at the walls? I was sent home from the hospital with a prescription for pain and some written instructions prepared by the surgeon. In his haste to leave town, he had failed to write complete discharge instructions. He did not warn me about the increased risks for blood clots following surgery. Later, I would learn that without a prescription for surgical stockings and strict instructions to remain active, I was in danger of developing a deadly blood clot. I would also discover that my doctor never picked up the pre-op lab report, which indicated that I was anemic. Performing unnecessary surgery on an anemic person should have been out of the question. Although I did not know these medical details when I left the hospital, I was still so distressed about the outcome of the surgery that I slept most of the next 3 days. When I got up on Tuesday, my thigh was painfully swollen, so I went back to bed feeling even more depressed. In the early morning hours, I awoke with a sharp pain on the inside of my left thigh. The pain was so intense, I thought it was a Charlie horse. By mid-morning, it was burning hot. By the end of the next day, I could see that my leg was twice the size of the other leg, so I called the doctor's office. The receptionist told me she would get back with me. I heard from her about an hour later. The doctor's orders were to soak my leg in hot water and massage the area. That night I told my mother about the doctor's orders. As I've mentioned, my mother was a role model for me of strength and wisdom, especially in the face of a medical crisis. You may recall that she was born with undeveloped legs and wound up learning to walk on prosthesis, without crutches. But there's more to that story. Early in her life, at only 13, she was the one who made the decision to have her deformed legs amputated. Yes, both of them. So she knew a thing or two about legs, and she didn't like what she was hearing from me. My mother also reminded me about my sister's thrombosis, and so she announced, "We're coming up there." Early the next morning, my parents left South Georgia for Atlanta. During their six-hour drive, my leg had swollen so much that I couldn't put any weight on it. When they arrived, Mama took one look and said, "Get on the phone to that doctor. You have a blood clot." We waited all day for his return call. At noon, the postman delivered a video of a program I had recently taped for public television. I popped the video into the VCR, then watched myself tell the story, "Why the Possum Has No Tail." It was to be the first and only time I ever saw myself tell a story on TV. At 6:30 p.m., when the doctor still had not returned my call, Mama made the decision. "We're not going to wait any longer. We're going to the emergency room." Daddy rushed me to the small podiatry hospital where I had the elective surgery just 5 days earlier. It was surreal. That entire day seemed to move in slow motion, like it wasn't really happening. I didn't try to make sense out of it. My life was speeding out of control like a runaway train. Chapter 6, Footprints. I glanced at the night sky as I dragged my left leg across the parking lot to the emergency room. It was a brilliant diamond-studded night, the kind that makes you sad because you know summer is fading. Little did I know that would be the last time I would gaze at the stars. My father had his own way of taking charge. He scurried in ahead of me to get a wheelchair. "Please don't fuss over me. I've been walking on it for 2 days now. I can limp my way in." Daddy ignored my plea. All I had on my mind was Jerry at the lake, taking the boat out for one last spin. I wished I could be with him. I tried to ignore the fear creeping up in my belly. Not wanting to alarm my aging parents, I forced a smile and accepted the wheelchair. We entered the hospital at 7 o'clock on September 2, 1987. As we arrived, I thought of Diane, my new confidant and medical guru. I hoped she was on call that night. Diane had listened sympathetically as I confided my fears when we discussed my symptoms. I would be more comfortable in the ER with a registered nurse friend by my side. Other thoughts flooded my mind. I had missed the last week of school in May because of the pernicious anemia. My family physician, who I'll call Dr. Wright, assured me I was fine on my last visit in July. I had taken all the B12 treatments he'd prescribed, yet the mysterious pain in my groin had continued to nag at me. Ideas of cancer had cluttered my brain and my reasoning. I'd also grabbed a chance to satisfy a bit of vanity with what was supposed to have been liposuction, in addition to the hernia repair. And the truth be told now, when I look back, I wanted to have my way, despite the wisdom and advice from Jerry, who I knew loved me despite his perhaps not-so-smooth communication skills. I thought again of Dr. Wright, who had been my family physician for 6 years. He knew me. He would have sent me to someone he trusted for a second opinion. Instead, I had listened to my new nurse friend and sought out for an opinion from a stranger, Dr. Gucci Shoes. Now I had a blood clot. Somewhere in my mind, I had a flash of the school bookkeeper grabbing my arm as I walked down the hall the day before surgery. "Don't go to that hospital. I've heard horror stories." What other signs had I ignored? What other desires had landed me on this runaway train? The plastic surgeon arrived about 15 minutes later. He examined the leg with a Doppler to measure the blood flow. He called in a vascular surgeon. Within an hour, a tall, lean, older doctor arrived. He examined me and recommended immediate surgery. I was scared. Things were moving too fast. The vascular surgeon was from another country. I knew that did not mean he was capable, but his accent was so thick I couldn't understand his diagnosis. All I knew was to call my new friend, Nurse Diane, who personally knew these MD's initials, which I now thought stood for medical dummies. Diane sounded surprised to hear from me. It wasn't like we were best friends and talked all the time. I told her the situation. Diane, I'm scared. Tell me what to do. Your anesthetist is the most important consideration, she suggested one, but I learned he was not available. Then she hesitated. She had no other ideas. I asked her for another vascular surgeon, at least one with better English language skills. The vascular surgeon she suggested arrived at midnight, looking sharp and fresh, as if I could really tell his ability by his looks. He was wearing a crisp blue Oxford shirt. He had coal black hair and dark eyes. I was in too much pain to notice his shoes. After examining me, he said, "Let's approach this more cautiously. Let's run some tests first." I liked the sound of that. Reasonable. Dr. Oxford Blue sent me to radiology for a venogram where the tech explained that the radiology dye they would inject could kill me if I was allergic to it. Why do you have to tell me that? I'm frightened enough. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I was wheeled into the intensive care unit of the ER. Every 15 minutes of that long night, a nursing assistant took my blood pressure by placing the cuff over my injured leg and pumping away. I wanted to scream. Wait a minute. Could this cause the blood clot to move? I never said a word. It was a long night in Georgia as I watched the IV drip. I felt so alone and helpless. I hadn't seen my parents since my arrival. I wondered if Jerry knew where I was. He would come and take care of me. If cell phones had been available then, I would have called someone. Early Friday morning, Jerry called. The nurse brought a phone to me so I could talk to him. Daddy had told him what was going on. He knew the leg had been swollen since he brought me home from the hospital on Sunday. He listened as I told him of the latest developments, then asked, "Should I leave work now and come over?" I protested, "No, you'd just be spending the day in a waiting room." I heard myself assuring him, "My parents will be here." Why do I put up a brave front when I want to shout out that I'm scared? I will always regret that I didn't see Jerry one last time before the surgery began. That afternoon, a test had to be aborted because I had an adverse reaction to the medication that was supposed to calm me. Now they had me on a morphine drip. At 5, Dr. Oxford Blue consulted with my parents and me about the next step. He recommended surgery because the femoral artery in my left leg was totally blocked from ankle to groin. "What does that mean?" asked my dad. "It appears there's a piece of the clot dangling by a thread. It's in danger of breaking off. It could be thrown into her lungs at any time. Your daughter could be at risk for pulmonary thrombosis." I was terrified because I knew that could be fatal. The doctor asked, "Do you want to have the surgery here or at St. Joseph's in Atlanta?" St. Joseph's was a prominent heart hospital 30 miles away. "What's the risk in moving me?" "Moving you could cause the clot to be thrown into your lungs." Well, by then I was so out of it I couldn't even remember his real name. "Have you done this surgery here?" "Yes, I've done it 3 times at this hospital. It's a simple procedure and you will be awake. We will insert a Greenfield filter into your jugular vein." He touched my neck as he said this, leading me to believe the filter would rest there. "The procedure will take all of 45 minutes. This was as clear to me as a morphine fog. "How many times have you done this procedure in all?" 25 times. Well, it never occurred to me to ask what could go wrong and what he would do if it did. I assumed that I understood well enough to make an informed decision. My parents were in shock and left the decision to me. Considering how dangerous it would be to move me, I opted for surgery at the hospital. In retrospect, I was making life-changing decisions under the influence of large amounts of morphine. Not good. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing. The doctor failed to clarify an important piece of information. The 32-inch long instrument launching the filter into my vascular system would be threaded through my heart to get to my groin. If I had known that, I'm sure I would have insisted on consulting a cardiologist about complications. The filter's function was not to capture the clot in my leg and move it to my neck for removal. Instead, the filter, imagine a badminton birdie with six fish hooks, was designed to anchor itself into my vena cava wall and break up the clot, eliminating the danger. Had I known the extent of this invasive procedure, my decision might have been different. Also, no one made me aware that small hospitals like this one sometimes do not have the proper equipment in case of an emergency. In 1987, there were only three hospitals in Metro Atlanta with heart-lung machines, and this was not one of them. Later, I would learn that any time your attending physician calls in a specialist, your physician should be present to help you make informed decisions. Dr. Gucci Shoes was in the hospital, but not present for the consultation. My mother, father, and I sat stunned, trying to absorb all this. I could only hope I was making the right decision. A nurse reassured me that the hospital had a new image, not to worry. Apparently, she was aware of the hospital's reputation. They prepared me for immediate surgery, but Jerry did not arrive until after I had been taken into the operating room. Lying on the surgical table, I listened to the preparations. They placed blinders over my eyes. I relaxed, knowing my nurse friend Diane was by the doctor's side. After the surgery began, I heard him ask in a strained voice, "Get me and then he named a certain surgical instrument that today I don't recall. What I do remember was recognizing Diane's alarmed voice, "We don't have that, doctor." I'm sure I fidgeted. What? How can a surgical center not have the instruments they need? He asked for something else. And Diane again replied in the negative. I wanted to jump up and yell, "What do you mean you don't have it?" Then he asked for a stainless steel wire. How strange. All this time I was in and out of consciousness. I tried to reason. I'm in an operating room. It's going to be okay. If I were on a battlefield, I might not be so safe. But the fact is this. At that moment, I was in a battle for my life. Remember that stainless steel wire? When the filter was dispatched, it misfired and began floating around in my heart. Rather than stopping to explain to the surgical team why the procedure was aborted, the doctor was attempting to pull out the filter using the wire he requested. And that wasn't all. To see what he was doing, the doctor would switch on a fluoroscope, a radiation tool he could use only for moments at a time, to see his progress, how far he'd been able to move the filter since his last look. So, after taking another quick peek, he would turn it off again and try once more to fish out the filter. He was doing this over and over, not knowing that exposing me to radiation, but doing this dangerous procedure in the dark, and inside my heart, no less. Of course, I would learn all this later, including the devastating result. His instrument had snagged the largest vein of my heart, called the vena cava, causing a tiny tear near my heart valve. I was bleeding out. My life was passing before me. I envisioned a large black-and-white clock that hangs above the chalkboard in every classroom in America. I saw faces of children I had taught over the years. Many of these were students who had made an imprint on my soul, struggling with their self-esteem, learning disabilities, or behavioral issues. I began praying. As I did, words from my favorite poem, Footprints in the Sand, rang in my head. You may be familiar with this poem. The author, when encountering the Lord, expresses gratitude that he always walked alongside. Then the author questions the Lord, asking why, when he needed him the most, only one set of footprints was visible in the sand. The Lord assures the author he was there when he needed him, carrying him. The words I recounted may not have been exact, but my Lord was listening as I prayed for him to carry me. I knew he would. Suddenly, a vision of Daddy flashed before my eyes. He was lifting me up, showing me how to chin myself on the chinning bar in our yard when I was a little girl. I knew he was there to catch me, but I held on desperately, afraid of falling. I felt the same danger in that tiny hospital as I held on for dear life. Dear Heavenly Father, please give me a second chance. I have so much left to do in this life. There's the fellowship and so many lives I want to touch. I don't want it to end here. I want to live. At that exact moment, I tried to sit up on the operating table. The drape covering my body fell to the floor, revealing what the vascular surgeon already knew. Diane gasped. She's cyanotic. As a nurse, Diane realized I was experiencing oxygen deprivation. The next thing I remember was the doctor asking, "Has anyone told her parents?" I wanted to shout, "Wait, told my parents? Am I dead?" I felt a rush, and that must have been when the hemorrhaging was getting worse. I prayed as my heart slowly deflated. "I'm in your hands, Lord. I can't hold on any longer." And then I let go, and God carried me. At one point, someone went to discuss the options with my parents. It was Friday night of Labor Day weekend, and the traffic was at a crawl across the city. Thank God Daddy had the good sense to say, "Don't send her to another hospital in an ambulance. Call Life Flight." And they did. Thank you, Daddy, for being on top of things. He helped to save my life. I vaguely remembered the whirling helicopter and Jerry running beside me on the gurney calling out, "I love you." The next thing I knew, I woke up unable to see. Chapter 7, Blind as a Bat. As I regained consciousness in the cardiac care unit, I was terrified because I couldn't seem to open my eyes and I didn't understand why. I didn't realize my eyes were open. I just couldn't see. My sister Sandra had arrived from Blackshear, Georgia. Jerry took Sandra's hand and led her into my room, explaining, "You're not going to recognize Fiona, so just be prepared." Sandra gasped, "She's not my sister." I looked like I had been hooked up to a helium tank and blown up. The blood from hemorrhaging had settled in my arms, neck, and head. Sandra told me much later that I looked like the Coneheads from Saturday Night Live. "You had no neck. The top of your head was narrow, then it widened out to your shoulders. It was so grotesque. You were unrecognizable." When Sandra found out that I hadn't told my friends about the surgery, she called them all. My closest friend, Marie, dropped everything to rush to my side. She, too, was shocked at the sight of me, propped up and puffed up like the Pillsbury Doughboy. Tubes were streaming from every orifice in my body. She squeezed my hand and whispered, "You wouldn't have made a pretty fat woman, girlfriend." We had known each other since we were 19. As we both grew into womanhood, I aspired to be the nurturing, charming, and talented mother I watched her become as she raised her 3 children. Marie stayed in the hospital for 2 days and cared for me as my Florence Nightingale. I couldn't breathe on my own. The tubes were my lifeline, but they hindered my ability to communicate with anyone. I tried to talk with the tube in my mouth. I wanted desperately to tell them I couldn't see. No one understood. Worried that I had no lesson plans ready for my students, I wanted someone to call the school to let them know I wouldn't return on Monday as planned. I anxiously tried to draw words on my sister's palm. I wrote for Sandra not to send flowers, but instead to purchase books for the school library. She let out a sob. She thought I was planning my funeral. I don't know what I was thinking. We were all in shock. To make matters worse, my period came unexpectedly, with a flow so heavy I was on the verge of hemorrhaging again. They sent someone to the women's hospital across the street for maternity pads to manage the excessive bleeding. These pads were so large I could have worn them as a bandana. No one offered me a sanitary belt to hold them on, and my family kept forgetting to bring my underwear. Whenever someone assisted me to the bathroom, the pad fell to the floor. Forget about dignity, there was none. The shock of waking up blind kept me from thinking about embarrassing moments. After a couple of days, I was moved to a private room where I was alone during the mornings. St. Joseph's was a Catholic hospital. Many nuns visited my room, but no one seemed to know what to say. The medical staff didn't talk to me or give me any tips about living with this darkness. They seemed to ignore the fact that I couldn't see. Apparently, the nuns didn't know how to give me guidance to help me move on and off the gurney each time I was taken to the lab for CT scans. They didn't explain why they weren't doing anything about what I assumed was my temporary loss of vision or what the treatment plan was. I don't think they talked to anyone in my family for several days. The doctors just kept coming in and examining my eyes and saying, you can't see anything? I imagine they look like the Three Stooges, white, wearing white coats and stethoscopes. That's right, I replied. Many unanswered questions would hang in the balance for 3 more years. However, by the time the doctors were trying to diagnose my lack of vision, I was learning bits and pieces of important information. For one, the fact that I was alive was a miracle. I had flatlined once during the flight between hospitals. Fortunately, they had equipment on board to keep me alive. By the way, Daddy's insistence that I be airlifted was insightful for a reason other than the danger of transporting me by ground. Seems the doctor, who was basically trying to fish an object he'd lost out of my heart, had nurses phoning other hospitals, begging for help. No doctor would commit because they knew they couldn't get across the city. It was Friday evening of a holiday weekend during rush hour traffic. I also learned that after I arrived at St. Joseph's Hospital, several friends and family members gathered to keep vigil in the waiting room. They had been informed that my condition was critical, that my odds for survival were slim at best. Several tender stories resulted from their time spent supporting me in this caring way. For example, my niece Paige called my friend Kathy, whom I had not spoken to in nearly a year. She had been my son's babysitter ever since he was 6 months old. Kathy and I were so close for 13 years, but a disagreement had kept us apart. She rushed to the hospital and was there by the time I got out of surgery. Kathy was the one who called my ex-husband and handed the phone to our son Chance. He and Chance wept together over the phone. Poor Jerry, he was having a different sort of experience. He'd been told by his best friend and a relative that it was a mistake for me to be in the hospital where the surgery went so wrong, but since we weren't married, he had no authority to have me moved. He spent hours trying to find another doctor who would review my case. By the time I was moved to St. Joseph's, he was so discouraged and exhausted that he spent most of his time in the waiting room with the others, slumped with his head in his hands, staring at the floor. After the A-team of heart specialists repaired my heart, which was my third surgery in less than a week, my parents felt that the crisis had passed, and they returned to my house exhausted. My son held my strong, capable mother as she cried, something we had rarely seen before. I met with the cardiologist who headed the A-team weeks later in his office. I told him, "God saved my life." He jokingly replied, "Me and God." He was a kind and brilliant man. I know God gave him miracle hands, and I began to think of him as Dr. Miracle Worker. After a week of the parade of doctors trying to figure out what happened, the vascular surgeon gave us the diagnosis: hysterical blindness due to trauma. He told me the consensus was that once the shock wore off, I should recover my eyesight. However, there were no guarantees. Due to the severity of the blood clot, I had to be on Coumadin. The blood thinner required a strict diet with no roughage, such as salads, because the combination could cause bleeding. My instructions were to call my doctor if I had a fever over 100. Well, this only added to my fear. I was fitted for expensive surgical stockings. Surely I won't get a run in these. It took a team of horses to pull them on. I joked that I would prefer a team of construction workers. During the next 2 weeks, while I was alone in my hospital bed, I mentally tried to lift the scales from my eyes. I saw Daddy, but I knew it wasn't real because in my mind's eye, he looked the way he did when I was a little girl. I also thought I saw my grandmother Graham, who had been dead for 3 years. Then I recalled that she was visually impaired from macular degeneration. I remembered Nellie, a neighbor from my childhood who was also blind. My memories seemed to establish a disturbing pattern. Would I be blind for the rest of my life? Being in shock is like living in a dream. You know life is moving along, but there's no sense of reality. The highlight of each day was Jerry's visit. He came around 1 o'clock to feed me. One day he was late. When he saw the food tray untouched and placed near the foot of my bed, he asked, "Didn't you get fed?" "No. Is my food here?" The food handlers, unaware that I was blind, had set down the tray quietly without speaking. He later had a sign placed over my bed telling hospital staff that I was blind. I was reminded several times how lucky I was that the A-team had been on call September 3rd when I was life-flighted to St. Joseph's Hospital. They were my knights in shining armor. These surgeons had saved my life. The captain of this amazing team, the remarkable cardiologist I now regarded as Dr. Miracle Worker, had taken a portion of the pericardium, which is the lining of the heart, to patch the tear of my superior vena cava. I needed heart rehabilitation. The next several days of recovery were spent teaching me to strengthen my heart. Losing 7 pints of blood in emergency surgery left my heart muscles so weak that I would have to do a lot of walking. Breathing on my own and regaining use of my arms were the first steps. I still had 7 pints of blood lodged in my tissues that had to dissipate somewhere, somehow. There was no question that this recovery would take many, many months. I wasn't clear-headed enough to ask anything. My prognosis wasn't discussed with me. The neurologist from my A-team was gentle. I had asked no questions. He offered no answers. But I didn't know what to ask. He would be the one to break the news in a later visit. On the last day of my hospital stay, the nurse helped me get dressed to go home. While my son was bringing the car around, she pulled the pink blouse over my head, but it wouldn't button at the neck. The reality of my swollen body sunk in. Tears streamed down my face. I couldn't even look in the mirror to see how awful I looked. The nurse brought me downstairs to meet my son. I don't even remember what we said. The nurse guided me into the low-slung Camaro. I could feel the warm September air kiss my face. It seemed to pick me up and set me down in the car. My mind raced. It was Jerry's birthday. I couldn't even shop for a present or a card. Anxiety crept in. What were the doctor's orders? I could not think. I rested my head against the car window and felt the tears dripping from my eyes. I turned away, hoping my 19-year-old son would not notice. He tried valiantly to cheer me up by describing the flowers along the highway. He couldn't know the despair I felt hearing about images I feared one day might be gone forever from my mind. A few weeks later, I was in my neurologist's office. The kind doctor stooped to tie my shoes and gently answered my obvious question, "When will I see again?" They had given me hope when I left the hospital. "The good news is that you are a walking miracle. You had a team of brilliant surgeons who patched you up." I quipped. Like Humpty Dumpty, I've been put back together again. Then silence for a moment as he gathered his thoughts. My dear, you probably are not going to regain your sight. It's possible the optic nerve could regenerate itself, but doubtful. It must have been very hard for him to say those words. An MRI had told the tale. The cyanosis I had experienced, or oxygen deprivation, basically destroyed my optic nerve, but the result could have been so much worse. When a patient is cyanotic, the blood pools around the vital organs for survival, leaving others to fend for themselves, which means that some parts of the body may suffer severe damage. The first area to lose oxygen in my case was the optic nerve. Doctors have told me this is highly unusual by all accounts. I should have been comatose rather than simply losing my vision. It's another lesson in how the body is a fantastic machine. In drastic hemorrhaging, such as what happened to me, the little blood soldiers run to the rescue. They stand guard at the vital organs until the bleeding is under control or death occurs. So many were needed to protect organs such as my lungs, and although they weren't able to guard my optic nerve, located in the head, I've been grateful for the work of these little blood soldiers during the precious moments when I could have suffered brain damage. I didn't comprehend all this during my visit to the neurologist that day. I don't know why Humpty Dumpty came to my mind. Maybe it's because I'm a storyteller. In fact, I was in such shock after what he said that the question flashed in my mind. Did Humpty Dumpty have trouble navigating his steps, cutting his food, finding his clothes, or did he even bother? I was faced with that reality. how easily depression can crowd its way in, even temporarily. In my case, I had a mother who taught me to face adversity with a sense of humor. I had the added benefit of friends and family members to lift my spirits. On the way home from the doctor's office, Kathy and I stopped for lunch. I met Kathy back when she was in my fourth grade class. She was a wide-eyed blonde whom I'd like to help raise. I'm as proud of her as a witty personality as if I were her mother. Trying to cheer me up, she said, "Let's look around in Macy's." I wasn't really in the mood, but Kathy was a friend who could always make me laugh. Walking wasn't easy. We giggled over how often we used the words, "look, see, and watch out." We stumbled along. Neither of us knew anything about sighted guides and how they eventually would become a part of my life. Suddenly, Kathy thundered, "Blind as a bat." She tried to get me to laugh to keep us both from crying as we maneuvered the public restroom. Quite naturally, she led me to the handicap stall. I discovered I did not like having so much space to feel my way around. And the toilet seat. Oh, how am I going to do this? What cracked us up the most was when I waddled out of the restroom asking, "Kathy, what's restricting my walk? Something feels strange. What is it?" Kathy laughed so hard that I could hardly understand her response. She maneuvered our quick U-turn back into the restroom and blurted out, "You forgot to pull up your underwear." I was so out of touch with my own body that I couldn't even remember that. My world was definitely upside down. I struggled each day to survive through the frustration. Like a bird with its wings clipped, I felt paralyzed. Eventually, I would learn to hone in on other senses, much like a bat. My family and friends were suffering along with me. They often cajoled, "Don't be impatient. You're pushy. Could you be a little less demanding?" They did not say these things in a mean way, but out of their own frustration. Marie told me later that they always waited until I left the room before they cried. Maybe I'm glad I couldn't see the grief on their faces. My blindness had created a communication gap. I had no visual trigger to sense their emotions. They had no point of reference for understanding the prison that darkness had created. The first time my sister took me for a walk, she guided me too close to a sign on a pole and I scraped my head. She said, "Don't cry about the bump on your head, Fiona. Things could be so much worse. You could be 6 feet under." We laughed over this. Comic relief, I guess. I'm sure she was crying on the inside. I can't imagine how many times Jerry fell apart when he looked around at how I had decorated my townhouse, remembering how much I had enjoyed it. Years later, he told me he cried each time he took a shower as he thought of things I couldn't do or see. All I could think of about was never seeing the sunrise, the faces of my future grandchildren, or my son as a man. I became frozen in time, left with the memories of the way we all looked when I was 44. Several weeks later, I met with the heart surgeon. I asked if he thought the patch would hold and shared my fears that one day the repair would split or wear out. His dry reply didn't give me a lot of reassurance. "I don't know. This was the first time I'd ever done this." At the time, I didn't know if he was joking or serious. He had no idea the impact that statement would have. Over the next year, I had several panic attacks that sent me rushing to the doctor. I was convinced my heart would burst. That's how they described my grandmother's death, her heart burst, which I believe was the way they described heart attacks many years ago. I went through a year of anxiety attacks, thinking I was going to die whenever I was under stress. In my mind, a fever meant internal bleeding. I worried about the strength of the patch, not aware that scar tissue actually makes it stronger. 6 months after losing my eyesight, I sat before my family doctor and explained that I didn't know why I had such a tough time getting out of bed each day. I wondered if I developed anemia again, a condition that had plagued me often in my life. "Fiona," said Dr. Wright, "you can't see the forest for the trees. You're depressed. You are an independent woman in a dependent body screaming to get out." I scoffed at the idea. He went on to say he believed in me and thought I would write a book someday dedicated to Krista McAuliffe. I didn't appreciate the wisdom of this statement at the time, but looking back, I understand. Every time I was feeling down, God put someone in my path to redirect me, encourage me, or make me smile. Amazing. Chapter 8, Friends in My Path. If it had not been for Elaine, my social worker friend, I would not have known the next step after my 2-week hospital stay. We'd met 9 years earlier on a trip to Paris. We were both bumped from one flight to another and sat in adjacent seats chatting happily about our tour of France. She was a cute 32-year-old single blonde, and I was 3 years older, a married teacher away from home for the first time. Like me, she was a take-charge woman. She came to my house to whip me into shape. When she arrived, I was not sure what to do next and glad for her take-charge personality. For the project for my Krista McAuliffe Fellowship had to be completed in 1 year. I would face losing it if I didn't start mobility training immediately. Storytelling gigs that had been lined up before I lost my sight were already on my calendar for later in the fall. I was determined not to cancel them. Plus, the members of Southern Order of Storytellers, SOS, refused to accept my resignation as president. They even reelected me for the next year. On Elaine's first visit to my house, she asked what happened to my hair. I told her I was way overdue for new color. My roots were surely dark, so I found a bottle of Clairol and attempted a touch-up. I figured it was a little tricky for a blind person to do this, but it was better than dark roots. Only you, Fiona, would try that. It's a disaster, girlfriend. We've got to do it again. That's what I mean about Elaine taking charge. After redoing my hair, she called a friend in a county vocational rehab office. By coincidence, he was someone who had sung with me in the choir at Kelly's Chapel Methodist Church 10 years earlier. Fred took charge by arranging for a counselor to come to my home. Just think, if Elaine and I hadn't been bumped from that flight, I might never have these resources. The irony was that earlier in the year, I had visited this same rehabilitation office as a speaker. And now I require their training as a client. Here's a quick flash forward for your amusement. The following spring, I was booked to give the keynote address at the Helen Keller Foundation Conference. I decided to speak about my first in-home rehab experience. The story went something like this. Unaware I was my instructor's first client, I was a bit unruly. She was teaching me how to protect myself as I made my way around the house without sight. For example, she told me to use my knuckles to follow the walls so I wouldn't injure my fingers when I came to a corner. She also instructed me how to position my hands as protection for certain parts of my body in case I ran into furniture when I moved away from the walls. But I was mischievous and couldn't resist making a joke when she told me, "Put your right hand in front of your chest and your left hand in front of your groin area." I piped up, "My groin area? What's that?" Her southern drawl was thicker than mine. She was not amused. I continued to share how she tried to teach me the way a blind person should pour milk, and I blurted out, "I don't like milk." She made me sew tiny braille tags onto my socks. I protested, "Do I have to?" "If you want to know the color of your socks, you do." She was serious. I was trying to laugh to hide my pain. At the end of my speech, a woman stood up and identified herself as that very rehab instructor. She was a good sport. So much for making fun of the teacher behind her back. When it came time to decide where I would go for mobility training, I was presented with two choices: Center for the Visually Impaired, CVI, in Atlanta, or the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation in Warm Springs, Georgia. After the interview at CVI, I called Warm Springs and spoke to the director. He described what a year of living in the dormitory would be like, how I would learn to navigate stairs, halls, bathrooms, etc. I shrank in fear. Could I do this? Staying at Warm Springs sounded very isolating. I pictured being in a strange place, having to find my way down the hall to a toilet and a shower. I had so many conveniences at home, and I was beginning to learn my way around my townhouse by feel. I was intrigued at how I could visualize my furniture. I wondered if I would always conjure up those vivid images. Would I forget what blue, red, and mauve looked like? I could see the mauve wallpaper I had put in the kitchen and bath just the year before. I knew my clothes. I felt safe there. Weighing my choices of Warm Springs in South Georgia or the Center for the Visually Impaired right in Atlanta, I realized what a frightening prospect it would be to leave my friends and family. Did I really want the challenge of a new environment for a year? Would I still have a boyfriend when I came home? I concluded that the Center for the Visually Impaired was a better option for me. Thanks to my friends, Elaine and Margaret Ann, I was accepted at CVI right away. Elaine had worked with their director. Margaret Ann and I had become friends when she supported me as the president of SOS. She had gone to college with the president of the Georgia Academy for the Blind, located in Macon. He helped her get me accepted because I had a fellowship and needed priority training. Yet another obstacle loomed. CVI had a waiting list. I could hardly believe all three of them pulled strings to get me in. My friends got me on the right track and accepted for training at CVI. When I got there, the counselor at CVI explained, "We typically discourage people from seeking training too soon after their loss. Grief of any kind, including loss of eyesight, can last 1 to 4 years, but they had made an exception because of my fellowship, and less than 4 months from the day I woke up blind, I was enrolled in mobility training, braille, and cooking. I still faced the challenge of how to get there each day. CVI was 25 miles away. My boyfriend worked in the other direction. I couldn't think of anyone who could help. Just in time, Bob happened to call to invite me to speak at his Kiwanis Club. I had met Bob after doing a mime storytelling gig earlier that year. We had chatted and I'd given him my card. 6 months later, he read about my fellowship and thought it would be an interesting topic for his Kiwanis Club. I rushed to answer the phone and drew in a breath when I realized it was someone I knew from before the surgery. "Well, something has changed since we met. I am blind." It was still hard to say the dreadful word. Bob didn't hesitate. "Don't worry about that. I had a roommate in college who was blind. I will pick you up and be a helpful guide." I said yes. Although I had other gigs lined up for later, I was bubbling over with the news of my first speaking engagement since going blind. At the same time, I was tormented with fears and doubts. Put yourself in my place. I'd been invited to speak on a topic that thrilled me, my Krista McCullough Fellowship to teach storytelling. Bob's Kiwanis Club would be a perfect audience. But would I fit in? Would they see past my blindness to hear my message? Would their interest and applause be for the cause of storytelling and the opportunity I was given, or would it be motivated by curiosity and pity for my sudden loss of eyesight? So many things could go wrong. Remember that Bob's telephone call came after I had been blind for about a month. I didn't have training yet on how to instruct sighted people to help me. I didn't even have a cane. I was at a point in my grief over the loss of my eyesight and the acceptance of its challenges where I was acutely embarrassed about my blindness. I felt like I wasn't a whole person, and yet I'd made the choice to be public about my condition by accepting speaking opportunities. Although I didn't analyze it this closely at the time, looking back, I wonder, was I operating from courage or ignorance? What a jumble of circumstances and emotions. For example, gaining a perspective of space as I entered the room where the Kiwanis Club met would take time, perhaps years. Would I be wobbly? Would I appear pathetic? I so desperately wanted to fit in with those people, able-bodied folks like I'd been only a few weeks earlier. Over time, of course, I came to grips with the reality that all people are imperfect in different ways and all have fears at some level. Yet back then, I already knew that blindness is a horrifying condition for most people. The fear of blindness in many adults dates back to their fear of the dark during childhood. Some people, deep in their subconscious, recoil from having contact with blind people, thinking, what if she bumps into something? What if the condition is somehow contagious? Of course, that last one is strictly a fear they can't articulate, but it exists all the same, because being in the presence of a blind person is a reminder of how fragile their own vision must be, how a surgery could go wrong for them also. The bottom line was this. Would my blindness be a distraction to this influential group? Would it negate the message of opportunity I would be presenting for school children to accelerate their learning through the storytelling technique? Would the Kiwanis Club members be watching for me to blunder instead of hearing my joy about receiving the fellowship, traveling throughout my home state and teaching these valuable skills? How desperately I wanted to rise to the occasion, to demonstrate my competence, and to live up to the professional ideals of the fellowship I'd been awarded. Bob's phone call began my long journey to acceptance of my condition and to wholeness as a person who considers herself blind yet having vision. I mentioned this in Chapter 1. My nightlife is 24/7. Here are a few truths that journey taught me over the years. As horrible as the experience has been in so many ways, I know God allowed me to go blind. Yet he has been with me every step of the way, from the operating room to the moment I am writing this very sentence to you, my reader. Because of my blindness, I have sought his guidance in a deeper way than I did when I was on a sighted path. I don't claim to know if this was God's reason. All I can say is what I've experienced. Another lesson I've learned in a more profound way is that faith requires an attitude of submission. It should be obvious to you by now that I am a strong-willed woman, and that submitting to even the advice and opinions of others can be a stretch for me. Am I stubborn? Yes. But now I work harder at accepting help, even seeking it. This chapter on friends in my path only scratches the surface of all the people who came into my life when I needed them, or who stayed by my side when they could have drifted away. I said I'm not a preacher, but I'll share a scripture that has particular meaning to me and may to you. It's from Luke 12:48. Everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded, and from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Writing this book has been hard and, frankly, expensive for a blind person to accomplish. But I believe it's an act of submission and obedience, so I can tell you from my experiences and from those, your life will be enriched. For example, I hope you are learning the realities, good and bad, of my becoming blind. Think of this. I came very close to dying on the operating table, but God allowed me to live. Also, no matter what might be our problems, and we all have them, we can learn coping mechanisms. In addition, I've learned that God is with us and he puts people in our path to help. As my story continues, I hope you'll see how I was in a sort of darkness before I became blind. Yet now that I live in literal darkness, I can see truths I never knew. I have a greater vision for my journey. It's what people of faith call seeing the light with a capital L. Ironically, the Krista McCullough Fellowship was a lifeline. It made me reach, and the timing was perfect. Well, back to the Kiwanis Club, where Bob turned out to be a perfect gentleman. He set me at ease until I realized when the food came that I could not cut up my salad or the steak. I turned to Bob, calling on my inner Southern belle and batting my eyelashes and saying, "I don't know you intimately, but would you please cut up my food?" He chuckled and complied. On the way home from Kiwanis, he asked a lot of questions about my plans. I told him I could not start my Georgia speaking tour until I had figured out how to get to CVI for rehab. The glitch is that the place is 25 miles from my house. I don't know anyone who isn't working. Bob called me a week later with a plan. He had asked members of his Kiwanis Club and their spouses to take turns driving me back and forth to school for as long as it took. The club presented me with a Braille watch at the next meeting so I could be on time for my rides. Bob and his friends were faithful, kind people whom I came to know and love. I thought my repayment for their kindness should be entertaining them with stories and wearing a broad smile each day. They never knew how scared I was while exiting their car, carefully tapping with my new cane to find the door of CVI. Friends come and go in our lives. Bob was there for a reason and a season. I will be indebted forever. I attended the Center for the Visually Impaired for 2.5 months. The recommended coursework was for 1 year. No, I didn't master Braille, nor did I master mobility. Practicing with a cane each day on Peachtree Street was tedious. I was not a good student. I was the kind of student who tried to coax her instructor to stop for coffee and a chat. I just wanted to be done with learning and get on with life. Chapter 9. They Say. The official Krista McCullough Fellowship certificate arrived in the mail just weeks after I returned home from the hospital. I eagerly tore open the package. As I pretended to feel the words, I found the national seal. My fingers traced it gingerly. It was so impressive. I stood there wiping away the tears. My emotions were a mix of sadness and pride. I thought again about that fateful day, January 28, 1986, when Krista McAuliffe and all those astronauts died aboard the Space Shuttle Challenger. Because of that tragedy, I had this award. In the blink of an eye, so much had changed. One thing that remained the same, though, was my drive to forge ahead. They say it takes years to get over life-changing events. I didn't have the luxury of time to recover from the trauma of waking up blind from surgery. I had to learn to cope. There was no other choice. I had to learn to dress, do makeup and hair, cut my food, and even eat. If I was to communicate in the sighted world, I also had to learn to use a computer. By now, just dialing a telephone stressed me. I cried over trying to operate a tape recorder or put in new batteries. There was so much to relearn. I couldn't even imagine what my future would hold. Little did I know this was just the beginning of my trials. I should explain that when I became blind, no meaningful legislative protection existed for people with disabilities. Another word I had a hard time saying. The Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law by President George W. Bush in 1990. Known as the ADA, it has been amended over the years, most recently during the administration of the younger President Bush. The ADA is a complex body of law which I won't attempt to explain, although I'm grateful it exists. It was needed not only to deal legally with issues affecting disabled people, but to promote a higher level of understanding. As you read this chapter, please understand that I am not complaining. I am only trying to give you a glimpse into my new normal a few weeks after losing my eyesight. Our time is up for today. I hope you can join me next time when we continue with My Nightlife is 24/7 by Fiona Page. This has been Renee Ford Clark for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.